For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
So good morning, Bodhisattvas.
Good morning.
So maybe this Dharma talk will be recorded thanks to our wonderful technology, digital technology. However, I never seem to get this right, so I'll keep practicing. Well, you know, when I say good morning, bodhisattvas, I actually mean good morning, beings devoted to caring for the world. So I always think it's a bit miraculous that we're all here together on a beautiful Sunday morning, choosing to be inside, supporting each other in this way. So thank you. It always seems kind of like a miracle that the Doan rings the bell once and we all sit Zazen together, and another amazing miracle that we sit Zazen together. Another amazing miracle that the Doan hits the bell again and we wake up and hang out together. So not a bad way. I always think about, you know, what are you doing here? Like, why did you come here this morning? You know, what brought you to this particular space? What was that intention? And that's all very personal, probably, for every one of us. So you don't have to answer that out loud now, unless you feel like it. Does anybody feel like sharing why they came here today? Donna. Bodhisattva.
I came here to show gratitude and humility. Oftentimes we seek out the Sangha, the Buddha, and the Dharma when things are not going well. But today, I came here to show appreciation for things going well.
So. Thank you.
I just got into grad school.
Congratulations. Far out.
Thank you.
Very happy things are going well.
Thank you.
Any other Dharma motivations? Yes?
I came to slow down my mind.
Is it slowing down a little bit?
Yes.
Okay. Lively dragon.
I came to hear the moon rap the Dharma.
Okay. So don't feel put on the hot seat, you know, to share why you're here. But I think, you know, thinking about what we're doing in practice, you know, sometimes in Zen there's this idea that we don't think, but actually we think all the time. And we say we practice, you know, this kind of effortless effort. But to kind of get in touch with that and understand it, I think it's really helpful to sometimes just pay attention to what you're doing here, you know. And that any reason or not having one is okay. Just the awareness of it already is probably enlightenment. I'm also kind of amazed at how we could possibly tear ourselves away from email and the internet and television and music and, you know, all the excitement that proliferates endlessly in our life, especially in this technological age. Like before coming to Zazen, what did you do? You know, how do you wake up in the morning today? And what was your mind state sort of leading up to here? Someone once said to me that it's kind of helpful to think about when you're doing intensive meditation, to think about entering that. How do you enter that? And then how do you leave it? And I think even in our, you know, it's pretty intensive for us in our busy lives to spend a Sunday morning on such a gorgeous day, you know, to come in here. So how do you enter that? What state of mind are you bringing to this event here? And then when you leave, like, what happens? I sometimes see, like, at intensive meditation retreats at the very end, let's say a 7-day meditation retreat where people are meditating really intensely, or even longer ones, month long, that there's like this event where there's like people finally get to talk, and it's like this insane chaos. It's like kindergarten. You know how kindergarten, everybody's running around like talking until the teacher calms them down. And so, and then, you know, they're eating and talking, and, you know, it's almost like all this settling just like erupts into this massive activity. So I think it's good to think about how do we go into things and end things in a way that's supporting our intentions. You know, I wondered, you know, who here this morning has already checked their email or surfed the web or opened their web browser and computer? How about looked at their cell phone, see if they got any messages? You know, I don't know, listen to radio or television or read the New York Times.
Watched a cartoon.
Cartoon? How fantastic. What cartoon was it?
You know, I don't even know. Not Word Girl. Something on public television.
Uh-huh. With your daughter?
Yeah.
Fantastic. So you know, we come into this practice with some activities already initiated, you might say. And this is the life that we are living every day. So I've been kind of, you know, thinking about this kind of like, how is information impacting our consciousness, this technological age that we live in? How is that going to be in terms of practice? You know, Soto Zen Buddhism has its roots in 13th century Japan. I do not think that Dogen Zenji, our great founder, had a computer or a cell phone. Yet he wrote this voluminous mass of stuff. So he was probably waking up in the morning, getting out his, you know, pen and grinding his ink, probably having somebody grind it for him, and, you know, zipping out these Dharma talks like I was typing out mine this morning. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a different kind of age. You know, and this practice of sitting quietly together, you know, it you could say Shakyamuni Buddha perhaps lived 500 years before the Common Era, but people have been sitting upright in meditation for thousands of years before that. And there's actually like coins that they found in the Indus Valley that are thousands of years old with people sitting just like we're sitting now. You know, probably if they have chairs, they'd be sitting in chairs or sitting on the bus or, you know, whatever. But so I'm just... Is there someone at the door? Sometimes that happens. So I'm just thinking about, like, how is our practice going to integrate into this life that we have that's so full? I'm wondering, like, if we've evolved to, like, some higher level that we can bear all these intense kind of distractions. You know, I mean, you know, like, we're drawn into this information age of where all this technology is happening. So, you know, there's endless opportunities to practice with distraction, you know, delusion, with clinging and grasping or aversion, you know, like you watch, like, you know, something comes up on the computer you don't like, you just click to the next thing, right? Like that. Music, you know, just on your iPod, you know, a little tune you don't like on an album, on to the next thing. So, you know, we all know that traditionally, clinging and pushing away or aversion or aggression or just being kind of, you know, out of touch with what we're doing, that those are the roots of suffering. Sometimes... Do we have a guest?
We have a guest.
Good morning. So So I'm sure that in every culture there are these potent forces to take us away from awareness and shift us off into some other realm of that keeps us away from our kindness and awareness. Those same forces, although, you know, they exist, those same forces might actually be vehicles for us to become more aware and kind and connected. You know, they might be like the sirens, you know, in the Odyssey, who call the sailors to, you know, visit them and then thrash them against the rocks and destroy them. But those same kind of sirens, you know, might actually help us wake up. You know, I mean, in the Odyssey, what Odysseus is strapped to the mast of his boat, because the idea is that if you hear these sirens, these beautiful females who entice the sailors towards them and then thrash their ships against the rocks and kill them, usually kill them. I guess maybe some of them survive, but their boats are pretty wrecked. To encounter that, you know, Odysseus is lashed to the mast of his boat, right? And he tells his sailors, under no conditions, let me loose. Put wax in your ears so you don't hear these sirens, but I want to hear them. And I think we're hearing these sirens continually in our daily lives with all of this technology that's calling out to us. And we, Zazen or a sense of presence or awakening maybe helps us kind of, instead of having to be like crudely lashed to the mast, you know, we might be encouraged by our practice to not be quite so impulsive and get ourselves into trouble, but actually benefit all beings. So we have these advanced practice opportunities. Before the era of the iPhone and some other things, 40-some years ago, maybe 50 years ago, actually, our teacher, who founded our lineage, Suzuki Roshi, kind of ironically came to America, and the first place he landed was right near the epicenter of the creation of all this information techno-explosion, Silicon Valley. So, you know, he came to San Francisco, and you know, this man came from Japan in a country that had been devastated by World War II and showed up here. And I think it's kind of interesting. In Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, Suzuki Roshi says, when we practice Zazen, our mind is calm and quite simple. But usually our mind is very busy and complicated, and it's difficult to be concentrated on what we're doing. So those words were even true before the iPhone or this digital recorder, which appears to be doing something, responding to my voice. So, you know, over the ages, we've all needed help to be kind of calm. So we have this meditation space, and if you kind of are aware, maybe, that this helps us perhaps to calm down a little bit and to support concentration and awareness. A student of Suzuki Roshi's, Yvonne Rand, has said, enlightenment is waking up in the middle of the habitual. So if we watch our habits to grab or to push away or to kind of, you know, space out from, that just actually waking up, understanding and being aware of that is enlightenment itself. So we have these like amazing opportunities all the time. And I think this kind of implies that studying the habits of our daily life is a great vehicle for awakening. So you might notice as you start to settle into sitting and calm down a little bit that you start to notice your habits more. And then you kind of have a choice about how you act or react to those. And, you know, the habits of our body, our mind, and our speech get illuminated in practice. So our quiet time together, you know, I think of this as quiet time, encourages this kind of settling, calming down, and then kind of awareness, expansion. So there's always this balance. So I don't want to at all give the impression, I love technology, I will confess that. And I think it's maybe I want to encourage you to kind of embrace the realities of your everyday life. And I'm focusing a little on the techno world today, but that practice is right before us. And there can be some difficulties with that, but I'm remembering, like, did anybody ever have quiet time during childhood? Do you remember? What was quiet time like for you?
Well, it was supposed to be quiet time.
Uh-huh.
There was always a lot of things going on. But it was supposed to be a settling time, right? Where everyone would just sort of take a breath.
Was that like at home or?
Oh, like in kindergarten.
In kindergarten.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Did you have in kindergarten too?
Yes.
Or, yeah. Anybody else?
Agitated.
What?
Opposite effect, really.
What did
it
you?
It was supposed to be a settling time, but it would make me so agitated.
Aha. Uh-huh. But you still lay there, were you running around?
I didn't really have a choice.
Yeah. Aha. Uh-huh. Zazen. Donna?
Yeah, I remember. I went to Catholic school, so they actually called it nap time.
Uh huh.
And it was probably into the first or second grade, if I recall.
Mm-hmm.
But when I got older, I figured as much as it was nap time, it was time to give the nuns a break, too. They needed it more than we did.
When I say that it's quiet time, it is a lot for that reason, too, because I need to quiet. I mean, that
with
time
Anne-Marie.
To refresh with Anne-Marie and then the other children, maybe, that I watch. So, yeah, I absolutely have to have it. For myself and for them,
mm-hmm.
I think it's important.
Yeah, so Dawn actually has a young child and also cares for other young children.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're aware of that energy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we have this kind of quiet time opportunity in Zazen, you know. I remember also in school, you know, like the intensity of running around on the playground, screaming, you know, getting excited about everything. And then all of a sudden, you know, some school bell rings and it's like time to go in, lay down on the floor and just be quiet. Even if I didn't want to do it, but somehow it's how we learn to regulate ourselves, you know, to settle down a little. So you can actually see that even though it agitates you, you could do it, you know. So I think that's kind of a cool thing. And I was reminded of this recently. I'd really forgotten about quiet time. And then I was reading a little piece in the New Yorker magazine by this humorist, Andy Borowitz. And it's called My Quiet Time. And I thought I'd share a little of this because I think it, to me, it was very thought-provoking and kind of funny at the same time. And so he begins this little piece with quoting a New York Times interview with Robert Iger, who's the head of Disney Productions. High-powered executive type, you know. I don't know this man at all, but I want to thank him for this interview. So the New York Times reporter said, "What are some things you do to manage your time effectively?" And Mr. Iger answers, "I get up at 4:30 every morning. I like the quiet time. It's a time I can recharge my batteries a bit. I exercise, and I clear my head, and I catch up on the world. I read papers, I look at email, I surf the web, I watch a little TV all at the same time. I call it my quiet time, but I'm already multitasking. I love listening to music. I'll do that in the morning too, while I'm exercising and watching the news." So Andy Borowitz wrote about his own quiet time. And said, "Whoever said that the early bird gets the worm could have been talking about me, only I'm a person, not a bird, and I'm not interested in getting worms, more like getting things done. I do get up early. In fact, my secret to success could be boiled down to three little words. My quiet time. It begins at 1 a.m. when I get out of bed, check my email, brush my teeth, scan some documents, and floss. Then I'll surf the web, maybe order a sectional couch or buy some Zloty futures. Last week I bought a Swiss chalet and sold it at a 20% profit while I was still in my pajamas. I wanted to high-five someone, but no one else was awake. Sometimes I can't remember if I flossed already, so I'll do it again just to be sure. While checking my email and maybe sending a fax. Did I mention the early bird gets the worm? That in many ways applies to me. By 1:03, I've had 2 cups of coffee, I'm down in my basement on the elliptical, my heart is pounding like a cheetah's. I know that cheetahs have a fast heart because I often watch Animal Planet when I'm not on the elliptical. Although sometimes I do the picture-in-a-picture thing so I can watch CNBC Asia while I'm watching the thing about the cheetahs. It isn't always about cheetahs. Sometimes it's about other animals like meerkats. I just said cheetahs as a for instance. There's no end to the things I can accomplish in my quiet time. I have a fairly nimble contralto voice, and after I pop an amphetamine or two, I'll work my way through the Metropolitan Opera repertoire, taking breaks to revise my will or maybe buy a fishing lodge. One thing I like to do is a controlled burn of dry twigs in the woods behind my house. I'll do the elliptical for 20 minutes, set fire to the woods, sing an aria from the magic flute, then jump back on the elliptical. Now there's something that honks me off. Neighbors who call the fire department when you're in the middle of a controlled burn. Those sirens start wailing, and before you know it, there goes my quiet time. I guess the world is divided into two kinds of people. Those who understand quiet time and those who don't. So, a lot goes on during our zazen, right? And on one hand, I'm thinking, you know, this is kind of a cool thing to be able to do so many things at once, you know. But I was, you know, a little worried. It made me worried about myself, you know, answering my emails, writing on Facebook, connecting to, you know, doing my billing, accounting for my private practice. And I thought, you know, what's my mind state during all this? And I think that might be this, you know, joking mind state is a little bit, feels a little aggressive to me. And I must note that over the years of practice, I'm humbled by my own aggression and drive. And so my response to that has been sometimes to slow down. And that's not an easy thing always to do in the world, you know, because people come and interact and, you know, what should I do now? Let's get this done. Let's accomplish something. And that's good to accomplish things. But, you know, it's also okay to check out actually what are you doing and take a little bit of time to settle with that and see if it's concordant or congruent with what's in your heart. You know, this must have been a problem in Dogen's time and in maybe time much further before that. In this huge volume written in the second century called the Abhatamsaka Sutra, the Flower Ornament Sutra, there's like a whole section, I don't know, maybe 20 or 30 pages that has little verses dedicated to cultivating an open heart and awakened mind in every activity. So while I'm brushing my teeth, I wish all beings happiness. While I'm putting on my clothes, you know, even while I'm using the restroom. And so that sense that we need to be reminded to be present, like I thought, you know, as I turn this digital, you know, recorder on, may all beings have the availability of the Dharma, which is freely circulating, you know, or thinking about turning on my computer and saying, you know, may this benefit all beings. May all beings realize the interconnectedness. Like this, the Dharma has never been more available planetary-wise since the internet. So I, you know, can't really fault it for that. But I think, you know, you can maybe build some things, or we can try to build some things into our life so that this practice infuses our activities. Kind of in checking out our practice, I guess the one thing I wanna mention perhaps is that Dawn is moving to her next activity, which will be to put some water in some buckets with some cleaning materials so we can do work period later today. So, thank you, Dawn. I guess I'm thinking about some things that you can use to kind of evaluate. And, you know, I don't want to be grasping to that evaluation, but thinking about evaluating, like, is this activity promoting mindfulness? You know, is this activity promoting flexibility? Is this activity cultivating energy in a wholesome way? You know, is there some equanimity about this? You know, there are certain factors of enlightenment you can kind of use in your daily life and check it out, you know? So maybe the elliptical is a really nice image, you know, because we're all kind of on some kind of elliptical. We're not really going anywhere. You know, even when we sit zazen, you know, we're kind of staying in one position, not going too far or going anywhere. So I think that that's okay, actually. You know, maybe that's like an advanced form of kinhin, you know, being on the elliptical, just kind of moving. But I think it's most important to just kind of check out your mind state. And are you awake? And are you expressing in our daily encounters, you know, are we expressing something that transforms them into this kind of sense of kindness and awareness and of peace and love for the world? So, I hope we all have fun with our technology and the kind of demands with which we practice. And I just want to encourage you in that. And maybe we could just take a few minutes to share any responses or experiences with your practice. Yes.
So it sort of seems that with this technology explosion, I mean, even starting back from when, you know, there was just TV and then there was cable. I think when I first had cable, there was like 30 channels, and now there's like 500. And then the internet and, you know, all these, technology just like bombarding us from all these different angles, sort of splintering and fracturing our mindfulness. Seems to correspond, like that technology curve seems to correspond to like the massive increase in ADD and medication and, you know, drugs and alcohol and all that good stuff. So my question is, I think in Zen Mind Beginner's Mind, Suzuki Roshi said, you know, our way is, you know, one bird, one stone. Not two birds, one stone. Not like five birds with one stone, maybe. So, for me personally, like, so would you say that, like, in the morning, like, trying to be mindful, like, just, maybe just eating breakfast, instead of eating breakfast, surfing the internet, doing email, and listening to NPR, just having that intention just to eat the breakfast, is that more, is it, would you say maybe that's aversion? Or not? And, or maybe you should just try to be mindful and embracing all of those activities that are going on simultaneously.
I would not advocate one strategy, but I would see what works for you in that situation.
What seems to work for me is to try to do one thing at a time. Because if you're doing four things at the same time, doesn't seem to cultivate, at least for me, concentration or awareness or mindfulness.
So study that and study how that supports it. Like, how does doing one thing support? And, you know, our bodies are actually doing a gazillion things at once. They're these huge energy factors with all these like microbes running around inside and heart beating, and, you know, so some part of our organism is really multitasking big time and seems to be doing okay with that. So I think you find what works, yeah. But you can find that, yeah, you get splintered and, you know, attention can get awry. It's difficult.
I think it is difficult in terms of knowing what to do for your own self. I know that for many, many years, I just loved to go to a diner and have a big breakfast and have a book and read and eat at the same time, and sort of losing myself in that moment was always really, it was very, very pleasurable to me. And then I realized the more I studied Zen that, well, there's a pleasurable side to it, but at the same time, when you're reading while you're eating, let's say, you're not really doing either one of those things very, very well. You're not eating with the kind of, you know, enjoyment that you could, for example. And when you're reading, you're certainly not reading to the benefit of, or to the extent that you could be understanding the text. So that's the thing that sort of keeps me understanding that process, that when I want to do two things at once, I always have to think that I'm not doing either one very well, so maybe I need to make a choice.
So something gave you some feedback about that, though.
It was practice, I think.
Yeah, so you noticed something.
Yes.
You know, you noticed a different quality.
Right, exactly.
That doesn't mean that you can't read at breakfast, maybe, but how that happens might be
different. Right, and this is the mindfulness of knowing the difference between, on one hand, knowing what you might be losing if you do two things at once, and on the other hand, knowing that sometimes that's okay, too. Just knowing the difference between the two maybe is the point. Be aware of that, conscious of that, I guess.
Then you make a choice that has certain karmic consequences.
Yeah.
Yes.
I always found it paradoxical that people who are very mindful and do things very slowly actually get a lot done. I was reading about the Zen, the monk Thich Nhat Hanh, and how he used to do things so slowly, but he was able to write so many books, do so many things, and even study so many scholarly things, and people around him were just so very amazed. So I like to strive towards that, but usually I think the habits are that we think if we go faster, we'll get more done. But there's some trick in there.
Well, and Thich Nhat Hanh depends on so many people. He has a huge sangha that supports him and helps him, and I think that when we do that, also when we rely on everyone else, that the whole world is helping us, that we don't feel quite as hurried, too. Because there are many things to be done.
I don't know about email. I'm not at risk of getting addicted to it because I'm a little old-fashioned and once a day is plenty for me. But what I have found is that if I begin to count on email for communication with some people, that it can bring a different quality to that communication. Or if, you know, like an incident that happened 2 weeks ago was I got a mass email from some people I care very much about, but it developed a very controversial back and forth discussion that became hurtful to some people. And it was like, I realized I don't even know half the people on this mass list, and it was very uncomfortable to me. So it's like trying to find a balance between not getting too mechanized or so fast in using email for efficiency that you begin to lose the personal aspect and realizing what this may or may not mean to the person on the other end when you can't read their face or feedback.
That it's really lovely that you're aware of that too, that you're actually thinking about how you might impact someone else. You know, so even in this medium, you know, that can be cold, you know, thinking about, you know, in some ways maybe I have to write my emails more carefully, you know, instead of just dashing them off, you know. There's I saw a book once that's like the protocol of writing emails, and I didn't get it, but I thought I probably need to study this because this does happen, and you know, there's danger in that for sure. But it's also the fact that you bring awareness to it is probably helpful.
I'm
I'm still getting used to this whole email thing because I'm a little bit behind. and cell phone. Like the only reason I had to get a cell phone was for my work with this child that I watch because her family doesn't have a landline. But I turn my phone off after 5 when I'm done. But in having to do emails more frequently, being involved here, you know, and so now I find myself checking more often because I need to in order to get communication. But I do find myself, like, if I don't get a response right away, you know, I'm like, oh, is this, then I start reading more into it, you know, because of that's who I am. But, you know, I'm like, oh, why hasn't this person responded to me yet? Like, why, you know, and I start getting hurt feelings. And, you know, my husband, Basil, you know, and he's been doing emails forever. And, you know, he's like, no, you know, and it's hard. Like what you said, you can't see the other person's face. You can't read the tone of voice in a typed computer screen. And so, you know, he's like, you just, quick to the point, you know? And so, but it's so different for me because I am more of an expression, obviously. Like, I mean, I talk with my hands, you know, I use my facial expression so much, so it's hard to get that across. You can't get that across in an email. So that's been kind of a newer thing for me to deal with, and, you know, so it's been kind of a tough transition.
So it kind of also illuminates our minds, like our expectations, you know, yeah. Like when we don't have all these other features that we habitually rely on for communicating, then we're like, oh my gosh, let me think, what does this mean? You know, that there's a lot of ambiguity, which I find actually kind of fun. It's painful because it shows us like, oh, I want this to be a certain way, you know, or I want reassurance that everything's okay. And, you know, see what happens.
Yeah.
It does.
I've noticed an interesting phenomenon too. I have a BlackBerry from work, so my email is always in my pocket.
Yes.
And it creates a situation where you just have to set up a barrier, otherwise it always doesn't work. And I've noticed that because of this, among the other people that I work with on BlackBerries, there's sort of unwritten rule that the rules for responding to the conversation are much relaxed to the point where it's actually exaggerated. You can wait a day to respond to someone because nobody wants to try to force themselves on you. Because everybody else also has the ability to ignore an email for a while if they're doing something else. Yeah. I thought it was kind of interesting. You would expect a BlackBerry almost to have the opposite effect. Mm-hmm. Everybody needs to hear that for the next.
So there's almost a social protocol that's developing to allow people some space to have a life that's not just... But it's interesting because in some ways, you know, the fact that we're so intimately interconnected is actually being reified by having our emails in our pocket. Like, you know, it's easy to kind of like be off by yourself and go, oh yeah, I'm not really, you know, I'm connected to everyone, but not really, you know. But when you're continually being, you know, getting voicemails and texts and all this stuff, it kind of shows us, you know, we are actually all bombarding each other all the time, and it's a pretty high level thing to manage. You know, to manage, you know, how every action we do is impacting everybody else, and to kind of, how do we deal with that? You know, it's kind of a nice theoretical idea to go, we're all interconnected, but if you start actually thinking about, like, that means that, you know, my cell phone is vibrating, you know, because I'm one with all beings. And it's not so convenient right now to be so one with everyone. I'd like to be a little less one. Younger bodhisattvas, you grew up with email and text. So what's this stuff sound like to you? A bunch of old people? Or, you know?
No, it's not. We just take it for granted. Like, if we get a call, it's just, oh, leaving a call. It's not something really new. But it's become part of our actual everyday lives.
Yeah.
So with emails, you're like taking it, analyzing it so much when you don't get responses. At the beginning of the school year, we got bombarded with emails from on our school email account, so that we got click happy and the delete button. So I don't know, emails aren't as serious as you seem to think.
Yep. So it's just sort of like, okay, I know what to filter out and what not to.
Yeah.
Except sometimes I might erase something that I need to know. Which I think is how we function all the time, whether or not we have this technology. You know, we kind of want to delete, you know, someone from our list or some experience. Like, I'll just, you know, pretend that didn't happen or avoid that, you know. Not respond to that being in front of me. Like, I was buying some bananas today for our treat this afternoon, and someone in the grocery store said hello to me, and I was like, hello, and I thought, you know, wow, somebody's saying hello to me. And then when I was leaving, I was like, the person who was the bagging person, but I didn't bag my groceries, but I just looked up, and I realized, oh, I want to, you know, do I really want to say hello to another person right now? and then I said hello, but, you know, and he smiled, and I thought, you know, there's always this like tension between wanting to like delete someone from my repertoire, you know, because we get bombarded by beings all the time. So I hope I don't delete anyone, but when I do, let me know. So, maybe this is a good time for us to end for today.